This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
So that those who were there will have it all summarized in one unit, and those who weren't there will at least have heard it and be able to respond to it. The medrash that I spoke about on Yom Kippur was a very strange medrash. It was a long medrash, but I'm only going to deal with one phrase of it. And that was during the Ilah we spoke about the strange background that the medrash gives us regarding the interaction between Yonah and the fish. It wasn't just a simple story that Yonah got swallowed by the fish and then he got spat out wherever it was. A lot went on in between that the Tanakh doesn't tell us about, but Chazal do. And relevant to us is just one bit of dialogue that took place, where Yonah in fact begins to realize that since he was able to see out of the fish, he wasn't completely insulated, he actually had windows that he was able to peer out and he was able to see the sea. So this was a wonderful opportunity for him. It was a submarine tour of the ocean. And as I pointed out on Yom Kippur, the ocean under the surface is one of the most beautiful places in the world. The coral and the colored fish that there are over there, if one's able to see, if one isn't so deep that you can't see, they're the most wonderful things to see. And Yonah got incredibly excited because this was an opportunity for him to experience the wonders of skin diving while reclining in the saloon of the fish's stomach. There he was really very comfortable, and it wasn't crowded, it wasn't cramped. The Chazal tell us it was like walking into a huge shul. That's how it was very comfortable, and there were chandeliers, there was plenty of light and good seating and good lighting, and he could sit there and he could peer out. This was just too wonderful. So he says to the fish, take me around, give me a tour. This is an opportunity that's once in a lifetime. Who has such an opportunity? So the fish says to Yonah, so through the intercom they must have spoken. I don't know how the fish talks to Yonah inside. Yonah's in the stomach. How do they talk to each other? But probably that there was some kind of intercom device between them. And you can just imagine it there. Yonah pressing the button and saying, driver, please, take me around, show me. And he says, one thing I have to warn you. The fish says to Yonah, there's one bit of warning. This is like when they tell you in the event of depressurization, you know what you're going to do. So he says, look, one thing I've got to warn you. There's a certain danger to all this. I don't think you realize that I am destined to become somebody's meal today. There's a big fish here, even bigger than me. And he's the Lev Yoson. And today is my day. I'm going to be the food for the Lev Yoson today. He's going to consume me. Omalo says, Yonah, don't worry. You take me to see the Lev Yoson. It's even better. Imagine to be able to see the Lev Yoson. Now, we don't know exactly what the Lev Yoson is. All we know is that he's enormous. We know that there's only one of him. And that he's somewhere in the depths of the oceans and nobody's really ever seen him. So this was a chance for Yonah not only to see the beautiful coral and the wonderful fish and all the beautiful sights that there are down in the sea, and particular things that he wanted to have a look at, but he even had the opportunity to see the Lev Yoson. And fearlessly he says to the fish, Holicheni etzlo, yeah, that's wonderful, let's go and see the Lev Yoson. And don't worry about being eaten up. Vani matzilo isivo ischol mipiv, leave it to me. I'll save you and me from the Lev Yoson. You don't have to worry, let's just go. It's interesting, it's all very well saying that, but the poor fish must have been a little scared. I only realized subsequent to this, to learning this medrash on Yom Kippur, I was asked to go up to Chobe Game Reserve for a day. I had to address a conference there, but part of the deal was that they would take me on a game drive, which they did, and it was very, very wonderful. And there was a buffalo herd of about 2,000 buffalo, and we had a wonderful tracker who was with us in the Land Rover, and he showed us where the 2,000 buffalo were, and he showed us lion on the one side. It was as if it was all arranged. It was too beautiful. And he said, now those lions aren't going to do the kill. Those are the lions that are going to roar. If we can get down round to the other side of the buffalo, we'll find the lions who are going to do the kill. And we'll sit and wait and we'll watch. So I thought, no, let's see this. So off he goes in the Land Rover, past 2,000 buffalo, overtakes them, gets to the other side, and believe it or not, taking a schlof in the shade there, they're three lionesses. He says, these are the ones that are going to do the kill. So we said, fine. So we sit and wait and we wait and we wait and we wait. and I'm supposed to speak. This is at about 8:45. We're half an hour from the hotel, and at 9:15 I'm supposed to speak. But luckily everybody was in Land Rovers. We weren't the only ones. Everybody was in Land Rovers. And then they turn on their radios, and everybody comes around there. So we decide that the speech will be delayed a little bit. We're waiting to see what happens. So we wait, and it's hot. 9 o'clock, 9:15. The buffaloes are slowly making their way, and the lions are still sitting there. So we said to the driver, it's getting a little hot, and we're a little thirsty. Can you get us something to drink from the back? That he didn't like at all. That he would have to jump out of the Land Rover and go and get the drinks out of the back, that he didn't like. But we persuaded him to go. There, this ranger, quite very brave, jumps out. And he's just between the driver's door and the back to get the drinks. And one of the lions just picked his little ear up. That's all. I've never seen anybody jump so high and so fast over the side of a Land Rover, into a Land Rover. He's scared. I told him he doesn't have to worry. There's Emuna, there's Bitokan, the Ribbono Shel Olam wouldn't do such a thing. He didn't want to know. There was nothing we could do to persuade him to get the drinks. So it's all very well, Yonah saying to the duck, don't worry, I'll save you from the Leviosan. How's Yonah going to save him from the Leviosan? But this was a wonderful duck, not like our game tracker. And he went and he did it. He took him. And they come to the Leviosan. It's a Leviosan. So he drives his way through the ocean and he brings him to the Leviosan. Amalei, says Yonah to the Leviosan, Shalom Aleichem. Bishvilcho yoradati liraisis medurcho vayom. I've come all this way just to visit you. This is unbelievable. I've always wanted to see a Leviosan. Have you ever wanted to see a Leviosan? No. We're boring old people. Just go around our routines. Have you any desire to see a Leviosan? We live in South Africa. You don't even have a desire to go to a game reserve to see a lion or a buffalo or a cheetah. We just carry on our old ways. The Victoria Falls. All these wonderful things on our doorsteps. We're not even curious enough to go and look at them, most of us. Isn't that so? Yonah says, a Leviosan. I've always wanted to see a Leviosan. Not a Leviosan. The Leviosan. But I've got to add something. But I've got to tell you something, Leviosan. One day I'm going to catch you and put a rope around your neck and throttle you and make a wonderful meal out of you for the tzaddikim. So we better get to know each other now already. Well, Leviosan, you can imagine, wasn't getting too happy with this, and you can just imagine how the poor fish felt, because now this is Yonah and the Leviosan are getting into a conflict situation. Who's going to suffer? The fish is going to be gobbled up. And when things started getting really hot, Herohu Chos Moshe Avraham Avinu, Yonah reveals to the dag the seal, the sign of Avraham Avinu, his bris milah. He bit the bris. The Leviosan took one look at the bris. The Leviosan saw the bris, and he jumped even faster and harder than the great game tracker did in Chernobyl Game Reserve. He fled 2 days, fleeing away from Yonah. That was the Medrash. So that bris that the Ribbono Shel Olam gave to Avraham in today's Sedra has some power to it. There's something symbolic. There's something deep in this relationship. What is it that the Leviosan threatens humanity, that the Leviosan threatens nature, that this enormous fish that was capable of swallowing Yonah, and you can imagine how big he was, it must have been a whale size, and Yonah sits comfortably in his stomach, this enormous fish is terrified of the Leviosan. And all Yonah has to do is reveal the bris of Avraham Avinu, and the Leviosan disappears, he flies away, it disappears totally. What is it that enables, what is it about the bris that gives such power to Yonah to enable him to conquer the Leviosan in that particular way? And in understanding that Medrash, we looked at a posuk in Melachim Aleph Perches, Vayikohalu el Amelech Shlomo Kol Ish Yisrael. This was when Shlomo was about to dedicate the Beis Hamikdash. All the Jewish people came. When was it? Beyerach HaEsonim Bechog. It was in the month of Esonim, during Sukkos, Hu HaChodesh HaShvi'i, that's the seventh month, that's the month of Tishrei. And the Targum translates that Yeroch HaYisonim is the original month, the origin of times. And we discussed during those shirim the different meanings of the word Eson, and we explained that the word Eson comes from the Aramaic Ito, which means existence, being. And that Eson, the month of Eson, was the month in which the world came into being. That's what Eson means. But we also noted that Avraham Avinu is called Esav. And that the Tehillim chapter Peites, I think it was, chapter 89, begins with Maskil le'Eson ha'Ezrochi. This is a Tehillim written by Eson ha'Ezrochi, and Rashi brings Rabbi Seinu Pirshua ba'Avraham Avinu. What is Eson ha'Ezrochi? That's Avraham Avinu. So that we see the name Eson attributed also to Avraham Avinu. And that's where we started building the theme around the concept of Eson, meaning existence, the month of Tishrei being the month in which the world came into existence, and Avraham Avinu. What's the connection between Avraham Avinu and the month of Eson?
There's a Gemara in Ksuvus Tavches, where the Gemara says, Kum eimo milso keneged menachme avelim. Come and say something about the people who Menachem Avelim, people who comfort mourners. Posach ve'oma, he opened and he said, Ochenu, our brothers, are goimle chasodim b'nei goimle chasodim, hamachazikim bivrusu shel Avraham Avinu.
They are doers of chesed, the children of doers of chesed, they are people who do kindness, and they are the children of people who do kindness, who hold on and preserve the bris of Avraham Avinu. And so we see here that the bris of Avraham Avinu has two sides to it. The bris of Avraham Avinu is not just the bris that we give a child at 8 days old. That's one part of the bris. But we see another element of it here, and that is goyim lechasodim b'nei goyim lechasodim hamachazikim b'brisu shel Avraham Avinu. Giving expression to the bris is not just giving the child a bris at 8 days old. That's not what the bris is all about. The bris is all of, it means living the life of Avraham Avinu. The bris means being machzik bivrisu shel Avraham Avinu, which is to be a gomel chesed. The essence of Avraham Avinu's life was one that was dedicated to chesed. That's the bris of Avraham. And we need to understand somehow the connection between the bris, chesed, which is Avraham, the month of Tishrei, which is the month of Eson, the word Eson, which means, where is all this connected and what is the connection? That perek of Tehillim that starts off maskil le'Eson carries on and says, Chaste Hashem Oilom Oshiro. The chasodim, the kindness of Hashem, I will sing forever. Ki omarti, because I have said, says Avraham Avinu, Oilom Chesed Yiboneh. The world is built out of Chesed. That's the construction of the world, the foundation of the world is Chesed. And Yiboneh is a word that doesn't just mean the past tense, it was built out of Chesed, but it means it is continuously being reinforced with chesed. But that's what it really is. If we look at the creation of the world, why did God create the world? How did He create the world? What is the function of the world? What do we find? Rabbeinu Sadia go and explains, why did Hashem create the world? Because part of being God is being good. You can't be God without being good. And being good, you'd have to have somebody to be good to. There's no to be a God and not be good, that's no God. So you were to be good as well. To be good, you need somebody to be good to. So He created beings to whom He could be good, to whom He could express His goodness. But just to give people gifts, to give people goodness that they don't deserve, makes the people feel condescended to. It's not the ultimate chesed just to give handouts. That doesn't build up people's self-esteem. That doesn't build up people's pride. To give them charity, to give them, Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon says, Na'ame dekisufo. To give people bread of shame, just to hand out things, that's not nice. So the Ribbono Shel Olam created a world in which people were capable of earning the goodness that Hashem wanted to give them. That's what the world was all about. What greater chesed is there than that? Hashem saying, I want to give, but I want to make sure that in giving, I preserve the dignity, not only preserve the dignity of the individual, but I build the dignity of the individual. That I give him the opportunity to build himself, to construct his dignity, to develop his dignity, his pride, his self-esteem. That's the most important thing. That's what I want to do. And so the Ribbono Shel Olam creates a world. And look at the world that He creates. Look at every part of the world. What goes into it? Nature, the botany of the world, the zoology of the world, the physiology of the world. Look at the science and the chemistry of the world, the physics and the chemistry of the world. Look at everything that goes into the world. What a universe had to be created for that. It wasn't just this little world. This little world was then contextualized into the universe. and made part of the universe. So you've got the solar system and beyond the solar system, all of that. Why did Hashem do it? In order to have a vehicle to give to people in a way that they could earn it and feel that they're benefiting from Hashem's goodness without loss of self-esteem, without loss of dignity. So far does the Ribbono Shel'olam go in order to be able to give of himself, to be able to give. And why does he want to give? Because that's part of being godly. In other words, if we track down and we say, what is at the source of all sources, what really is the original motivation of anything? If you go, you can nearly every motivation you can track to something else. And the psychologists are quite good at that. Why does a person do that? Because that happened to him. And why did that happen to him? Because something else happened to him. And why did that? Because when he was a child, his mother did such and such. And why did his mother do such and such? Because when she was a child, such and such happened to him. You can go back and back and back and back and explain through some kind of cause and effect why everything happens. But is there a point at which a human being can originate something that isn't caused by anything else other than the fact that he desires to do it, that he wants to do it? So if we go back and say, well, there must be the very origin of the world, let's examine how the whole world started. What is the most unique, what is the most original motivation, what is the most original feeling, what is that force that drives a being to do the first thing before there is any cause, before any psychologists were even thought of, before any scientists could explain cause and effect? What was the first cause of all causes? Was the Ribbono Shel Olam saying, I want to do chesed. That was the first cause of all causes. And that still remains until today. The only cause that is not caused by anything else. The human being has a natural desire to create. The human being has a natural desire to give. The human being has a natural desire to give chesed. And that is not attributed to any other cause before that. That's not attributed to any external factors. That's part of the godliness of the human being. Just as the Ribbono Shel Olam himself started off with that motivation, not caused by anything else other than the desire to give of himself, but to give in such a way that the dignity of the recipient is preserved. That's what's important. Because one of the easiest ways to destroy the dignity of a person is to give him something that he hasn't earned. That's one of the biggest ways to destroy his dignity. And the Ribbono Shel Olam is careful. He allows himself to make available to us limitless goodness. The amounts that we can draw on are absolutely limitless. All we have to do is draw. But we have to do that. We have to do something to be able to entitle us to all that goodness that is made available for us. So that was the very first act of the creation of the world. When Avraham discovers that the world has a creator, what does that mean? I've spoken several times recently how we tend to oversimplify the things in the Torah, particularly with respect to Avraham Avinu. We talk about Avraham was the discoverer of monotheism, that Avraham discovered the one God. And we've often commented that that's nonsensical. The existence of a single God is something that was known before. That was not a chidush of Avraham. That was known from the time of Adam. Adam knew that there was one God. Adam taught his children that there was one God. And all the way through there was a community of people. There was the yeshiva of Shem Ve'eva. There was at least one community of people that we know of that right throughout that period knew and believed in one God. So what was Avraham's chidush? What did Avraham discover that was so brilliant? What Avraham discovered was the connection between that one God and the force of creation. That one God is the creator. And what does creation mean? Creation means that I don't just evolve something that is caused by some earlier cause, that I'm just the link between some earlier cause and some later effect. That's not creation. Creation is something that starts with me. Creation is something that wasn't caused by something external to me. Creation is something that starts with me. So the creation of the world is something that started with Hashem. That's what Avraham understands. That's what Avraham observes. And what is that? The desire to do good. That's what it started from. And Avraham's chidush, Avraham's innovation was that the human being has within himself that aspect of godliness, and therefore just as God's most fundamental motivation, so to say, is the desire to do chesed, so the human being's most basic drive is also the drive to do chesed. That was Avraham's middle. And that's why we say Avraham was the discoverer of chesed, not just the discoverer of God. We don't really see, whenever Chazal talk about Avraham, we don't talk about Avraham, except one Chazal. He worked out that the world must have had a master, that somebody must have fashioned it, that somebody must be running it, that somebody must control it. But generally when we talk about Avraham's innovation, we talk about chesed. We don't talk about his innovation in Ben Odom Lamochim, in his relationship with God. We talk about his innovation in relationship to fellow human beings, the concept of chesed. And that's why we learned last night in the Medrash that what disqualified Lot from forming part of Avraham's community was not any diminishment of his belief in the Ribbono Shel Olam. And Rabbi Finkelstein pointed out to me this morning that there are many conflicting chazals about Lot. Some paint him as a tzaddik and some paint him as a rosho. Some paint him as a righteous man and some paint him as a wicked man. And it's very difficult to reconcile. We see when the angels came to visit him, he was eating matzah. It wasn't even Pesach yet. There hadn't even been a Yetzias Mitzrayim yet. But it was in Nisan. It was the time in which there would be Pesach, and Lot was eating matzah. And you can imagine what matzah he was eating. It was Badatz matzah from Yerushalayim. It wasn't just Mazmox or anything like that. You can imagine what kind of Hechsher was on it and how careful he was. So we see that in the laws of Kashrus and the laws of Yom Tov and the laws of Shabbos and all these areas, Lot was absolutely meticulous. Why does Avraham say no place for both of us? You can't remain as part of my community, as I said last night, because you don't do business the way I do business. That's why you can't. You daven the way I daven, and you eat matzah the way I eat matzah, and you go to shul the way I go to shul, and you keep kashrus the way I keep kashrus, and you put on tefillin the way I put on tefillin. That's all fine. But you don't do business the way I do business. And therefore you can't stay in my community. Because Avraham's chidush, what Avraham stood for, was not just believing in the Ribbono Shel Olam, but believing in the implication of the belief in Ribbono Shel Olam. To believe in God is easy. Today everybody believes in God. Who doesn't believe in God? Virtually every religion. And that covers hundreds of millions of people. Today believe in God. So in what way is the Jew unique? Because we believe in the implications. What does that mean, you believe in God? Therefore what? If you believe in God, what is the consequence of that belief? Says Avraham Avinu, the consequence of that belief is chesed. And if you're not practicing chesed in the deepest sense of the word, which is the sense of creation, of wanting, of needing to be good, of needing to give of yourself and creating the circumstance and the vehicle for that, then there's no belief in God. And what does that chesed mean? What does it mean, the need to create? It doesn't also just mean manipulating things in a way which is chesed. That's not the ultimate of chesed yet. So you've got some food here and you give the food to a poor man. It's an act of chesed. Somebody needs help and you give the person help. All that is an act of chesed. But that's not the chesed of Avraham Avinu. That's not the chesed of the Ribbono Shel Olam. When God wanted to do chesed, he didn't just manipulate things around, move a piece of food from this table to that table. That isn't what Hashem did when he wanted to do chesed. Look what Hashem did when he wanted to do chesed. He created universes to have vehicles for the chesed in the most unique way, in the most innovative way. That's the chesed Avraham realizes. That the human being has to create a vehicle for giving of his chesed. And he has to ask himself, in what way am I going to give chesed? What does chesed mean? If I'm going to simply do what anybody else could do, that's not chesed. If an individual is doing something that anybody else could do, that's not chesed. Chesed is to be able to do something with myself, to be able to make a contribution that nobody else can make. That's chesed. To be able to find within oneself the uniqueness of one's potential contribution and to define that uniqueness and to make a contribution in that area of uniqueness, that's chesed. That means I'm contributing to the world in a way that nobody else can contribute, because I found my particular unique constellation of experience. Every human being has different talents and different experiences. There are no two human beings who have the same constellation of everything. Upbringing and personality and intelligence and experiences and relationships. Everybody's different. And if a person will utilize all of that in order to formulate his contribution, and in everything, I'm just talking about one major contribution, in the way he does everything, that the way he speaks to somebody, that the way he interacts with somebody, that the way he relates to people is unique to him. He does it in his own special way, that is his own stamp of his own personality. That's chesed. That means I'm making a contribution that nobody else could make. If you walk into a room and it doesn't make any difference, nobody really notices whether you're there or you're not, and it wouldn't be any difference if you came or you didn't come. If you sit down at somebody's table and you eat their food, and it really doesn't make any difference if you were at the table or not, you haven't contributed anything at all to the atmosphere, to the feeling, to the discussion around the table. That's nothing. That's no contribution. There has to be something that you contribute to every interaction that is uniquely yours. When you come into shul and you daven, there should be a difference. It should be a different davening. The minyan should be different to what it is if you're not there. People should say, where is he today? The absence should be noticed. That means the person is making a unique contribution. If the person just operates mechanically and goes through the various routines of life without working out in any kind of way how he can bring to bear his life experience on every interaction that he has, that's not chesed. That's not contributiveness. And that's what Avraham Avinu is. That's the Brisoi Shel Avraham Avinu. What is the Brisoi Shel Avraham Avinu? So we see that Hashem instructs us to stamp that bris on the aver, on the limb which represents more than anything human creativity, on the human ability to recreate itself, to recreate life itself. That's where the bris is. And the bris is that the human being takes part in the completion of the creation. That when a baby is born, he's born incomplete. We have to finish the job. And where do we finish the job? On that limb which is most representative of the human being's capacity to be creative, of the human being's capacity to reproduce himself. That's why Chesed and the Bris come together. That's why it's Avraham who is given the Bris, because it's Avraham who discovers what Chesed really needs to be. The human being's capacity to create. And when a parent creates a child, does he create a carbon copy of other children? Does he create a carbon copy of himself? What parent would have children if you knew exactly the genetic engineering that they're talking about at the moment? If you can put in an order and have it made exactly as you want, it would take a lot of the creative drive out of the whole process of reproduction. No, every parent creates a child that is absolutely unique. There's never been one like him or her, and there never will be one like him or her. And that's the specialness of that act of creation. And even the siblings, even the other brothers and sisters, each one is totally different. There are no two of them that are in any way similar. They're absolutely different. They're absolutely unique. And nobody could have made that child other than those two parents. And that's part of the uniqueness of the creation that the Ribbono Shel'olam wants us to become aware of in the bris of Avraham Avinu. That's the uniqueness of this bris. This isn't just a formula that one has to go through. And this isn't just an understanding or a decision that you've got to do kindness. This is an understanding that you have to be productive, that you have to create, that you have to create beings, that you have to create people, that you have to create situations, and that what you create has to be an expression of your own uniqueness, and therefore what you're creating has to be absolutely unique. And driven by what? Driven by your desire to create, that's all. That's what Chesed has to be, and that's what Avraham brought to bear on the world. And that's why Chazal say that bris, that very first bris, took place in Tishrei, took place also in that month of Eson, and it was Avraham Avinu who is called Eson, and Eson comes from the word meaning existence, originality, that very first force, that month of Tishrei. That's why Chesed ties into that. That's the connection that occurs in all of that. And we took it a little bit further as well over Sukkot and explained that Tishrei, there's another thing that happened in Tishrei that was rather important. And that is that the second tablets of stone were given in Tishrei. The second giving of the Sefer of the Torah. The first time the Torah was given, it was given on Shavuos, on Sivan. And then, you'll remember, the golden calf, the tablets were broken, Moshe goes back onto the mountain, he comes down again on Yom Kippur. That's when we got the second set of Luchos. And I explained to you the piece of the Netziv in Parshas Kitiso, where he tackles the Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra quotes a Gaon, and the Gaon said, "The luchos shnios mechubodi min harishonim," that the second set of luchos were greater than the first. That's what the Gaon says. The Ibn Ezra quotes it, and the Ibn Ezra writes on that, "Ve'ele kedivrei chaloim, loy malin v'loy meridim." In simple English, that means that's a lot of nonsense. So the Ibn Ezra says, quotes the Gaon, who says the second set of luchos were greater than the first, and the Ibn Ezra says that's nonsense. How could that be? The first set of luchos were made by Hashem himself. The second luchos were written by Moshe. Hashem dictated them. The first luchos is what Hashem really wanted to give us. The second luchos was only b'dieved. It's because there was the golden calf, and it was only after the tshuva, the whole thing, came the second luchos. How can you say the second luchos are greater than the first? And then the Netziv tackles the Ibn Ezra, and he brings proof after proof after proof that in fact the second luchos were greater than the first. But then he goes on to explain why. And he says, the intention in all this is nisan, in the first luchos there was no capacity for innovation. Had the Bnei Yisrael not sinned with the golden calf, had we been left with the first set of the tablets of stone, we would not have had the capacity for innovation in Torah. All we would have had is what Moshe gave us on Sinai. But we would not be permitted to extend and to innovate halachic concepts beyond that.
But
with the second set of luchos, there was granted the power to innovate, the power to be creative within the authentic structure of the Torah, using the methodology and the principles that Moshe was taught that second time. So the first time Moshe was not taught methods of innovation. The second time he was taught methods of innovation. And since that second time, our style of learning has changed. Instead of being one of absorbing God's knowledge, the method has now become absorbing God's knowledge and knowing how to reason with it, how to think with it, how to draw conclusions with it. And that's why Hashem instructed that the second set of luchos should be chiseled by the hand of Moshe. Not because they weren't worthy of the hand of God. But to teach that there's been a change. That the halacha, the type of learning that results from this second giving of the luchos, he ha-hishtatfus omal ha-odom b'siyata dishmaya, is a partnership between the toil of man and the giving of the Ribbono Shel Olam. That in order to understand Torah now, man has to apply his intellect in a natural way, in a logical, rational way, and in addition to that, there's a supernatural element that the Ribbono Shel Olam grants to us as we learn and enables us to understand. But that partnership has to take place. The first luchos was a one-way dialogue. Hashem talked, we listened. That was all. The second set of luchos is an interaction between God and us. We actually have to struggle and battle to understand it, but through that we're able to innovate, we're able to be original. Just as the actual luchos themselves were such a partnership. It was chiseled by Moshe and dictated by God. And he goes on to explain that even though Kedushas HaRishonim Oysom Na'aleh Mehem, the holiness of the first was, there was more holiness because that was made only by God. But as we deteriorated and we needed a different attitude, a different approach, the second one came. And then he goes on to say it's the same with the two Talmudim, the Yerushalmi and the Bavli. The Yerushalmi is more accurate, but the Bavli is more logical. And there's a difference between that. The accuracy has greater kedusha, the accuracy has greater sanctity. But the rational one is the one that has greater innovation. And that's why we learn the Babylonian Talmud, we learn the Talmud Bavli, we don't learn the Talmud Yerushalmi as a matter of routine. And so he goes on and develops it further. So again, in the month of Tishrei, we were given, not only was the world created, and that was God's innovation, but it was also at that time that the second set of luchos were given, that we shifted the way we relate to the Torah from being one of merely of being recipients to being partners with God in the act of creation. We also learned that there's a piece of Vilna Gaon that Rav Huttner brings, where the Vilna Gaon explains why we keep Sukkos on Sukkos and not on Pesach. What happened in Tishrei that we're celebrating? We're celebrating the fact that while we were going through the desert, we were protected by the clouds of glory. So surely the time to celebrate that is Pesach time, when we were taken out of Mitzrayim. That's when the clouds of glory started. Why do we do it on the 15th of Tishrei? What historic event took place on the 15th of Tishrei that we celebrate with Sukkos? Pesach, we celebrate the Geula, the coming out of Mitzrayim. Shavuos, we celebrate the giving of the Torah. That took place on that day. On Rosh Hashanah, we celebrate the giving of the creation of the world. It took place on that day. Yom Kippur, we celebrate the giving of the second luchos, Hashem accepting our tshuva on Yom Kippur. On each Yom Tov, there's something that took place on that very day. Sukkos is the only Yom Tov where nothing took place on that day. Explains the Vilna Gaon as follows. Kashe osu es ha'igel, when they built the golden calf, nistalku ha'anonim, the clouds of glory disappeared. And the clouds of glory didn't return until they started building the Mishkan. So, and then he calculates. Moshe yorad b'yom ha-kippurim. Moshe came down from the mountain on Yom Kippur. Uvo mocharas yom ha-kippurim vayakhel Moshe. The next day Moshe got all the people together. It's the day after Yom Kippur, on the 11th of Tishrei. Moshe got all the people together. Then it says, v'ha'am heviu oid ba'boike ba'boike. he told the people to bring donations to build the Mishkan, and it says they brought baboike in the morning and in the morning. Says the Vilna Gaon, that means they brought for 2 days. They brought donations. That's the 12th of Tishrei and the 13th of Tishrei. Uve Yudal Tishrei notlu kochachom leiv Moshe asazol b'minyan of the Mishkan. On the 14th of Tishrei, Moshe commissioned the talented people, the artists who were able to construct the Beis Hamikdash, and he gave them all the raw materials. Uve Tesva b'tchilu la'asos, and it was on the 15th of Tishrei that they began the function of building the Mishkan. Va'az chozru anani chovoid. And then the clouds of glory returned. And that's why we keep Sukkot on the 15th of Tishrei. That wasn't the day the clouds of glory were first given to us. That was the day the clouds of glory were returned to us after we lost them at the Egel Hazor. And so we see here a similar theme to the one of the giving of the Torah on Yom Kippur, the two Torahs. We had the Torah given at Sinai, in Sivan, on Shavuos, but that was a handout. God just gave it to us. It had greater sanctity, but it wasn't something we created. We played no part in the receiving of that Torah. Comes Yom Kippur, and there's a new Torah given to us. The second Torah, the second set of Luchos are given to us. And that's a partnership between us and God. That we have to work, we have to function in a creative relationship with the Ribono Shel Olam in order to produce that Torah. And that's the Torah we still have today. When we came out of Mitzrayim, God gave us the Anon Echaveh, He gave us the clouds of glory. We lost the clouds of glory. And He didn't give them back to us until we earned them. After we'd done tshuva and we'd been through Yom Kippur, and then we started to build the Mishkan, when we, through our own efforts, earned the clouds of glory again, they came back. So the second clouds of glory differ from the first clouds of glory. And it's the second ones we're celebrating on Sukkot, not the first ones. We're not celebrating what God gave us. We're celebrating what we were able to earn in the clouds of glory coming back to us at that particular time. That also took place in the month of Tishrei. And so we see a trend that goes right the way through, that the Ribono Shel Olam seems to bring us into situations where we have to be actively involved in producing, in contributing, in making, in doing something, in making a contribution, not sitting back passively waiting for things to happen. Because that was the aim of the whole world, that Hashem would be able to give us things, but only if we did something to deserve them. We would be the creators of the goodness that we were getting. That's what Hashem did. He gave us the capacity to create the circumstances for Him to give us the good. But that's based on that chesed. We, through the chesed that we're able to do, through the contribution we're able to make, are able to deserve the contribution that the Ribono Shel Olam wants to make. Now let's go back to our friend the Lev Yosson. I explain to you that the Lev Yosson is an interesting fellow, because we find Chazal tell us that there were originally two Lev Yosons, as there was everything else. There was a mommy Lev Yosson and a daddy Lev Yosson. And the Ribono Shel Olam pickled the mommy Lev Yosson for Steven Spielberg to make Jurassic Park out of. And the daddy Lev Yosson, he sterilized. So here we have the only creature in the world that has never reproduced. That's the concept of a Lev Yosson. The only creature in the world that has never reproduced. Now animals and nature contribute to the world, that nature is creative. But most of the creation of nature comes from its reproductive drives. The fruit that we eat, the milk that we drink, the eggs that we eat, all come as a result of an animal's or nature's drive to produce. It also has, it's not just the human being, even nature has a desire, a drive, an innate drive to give of itself, to contribute, to reproduce itself, to create abundance, except one creature. Anybody else in the world who has not had a reproductive drive has become extinct. There's one creature that has survived without a productive drive, and that's the Lev Yosson. And whenever we find the Lev Yosson mentioned, he's always mentioned as a consumer. What did the fish say? I'm about to be consumed by the Lev Yosson. No benefits. We don't get any kind of benefit from the Lev Yosson. What does he do? What is his function? There's no Chazal that tells us what the Lev Yosson does for us. One day we're told we're going to eat him up. The tzaddikim are going to eat the Lev Yosson up, and his skin will be used to make a sukkah. All sorts of interesting things which we won't get into this evening. But during the lifetime of the Lev Yosson, which spans the whole of the lifetime of the world, the Lev Yosson has contributed absolutely nothing to society, to life, to the world, to nature. All it does is it consumes, it eats and eats and eats and eats, and it produces nothing at all. And I explained on Sukkot that the world is divided into two types of beings, those that consume and those that produce. And we can go further and we can say, in fact, that anybody at any given moment is either a producer or a consumer. Because at worst, even if you're sitting and doing nothing, you're using up oxygen. So you're consuming. And the only justification you have is, yes, I'm consuming oxygen, but I'm doing something with it. I'm producing, I'm creating ideas, I'm creating chesed, I'm creating interrelationships, I'm creating wealth, I'm doing something. But if you just sit there using up the oxygen and eating up the food and not creating anything and not contributing anything, then one is a consumer, not a producer. And so the world is really divided up into those that consume and those that produce. Africa is a very worrying place, because Africa has a lot of natural resources, and yet its percentage share of international GNP has been decreasing forever. It's never gone up. And I think it's now somewhere around 1% or 1.5%. Look at the size of Africa. Look at the population of Africa. Look at the resources of Africa. And it's producing 1.5% or somewhere between, I think it's between 1 and 1.5% of international GNP. That's very, very, very troubling. That's a society that consumes. It's not a society that produces. But it's not only Africa. It's all over. In many, many areas it's a problem. And the problem is partially that, it's interesting, how is status measured? Is status measured by how much you consume or by how much you produce? Think about it a moment. It's measured by how much you consume. What kind of car you drive, how big a car you drive, what kind of house you live in, how much money you spend determines what your status is, not how much money you generate, not what you've created, not what you've contributed. That's not how people are measured in terms of status. So our whole system of operation is one where the more you consume, the better off you are, not the more you produce, the better off you are. And that is the conflict between Avraham and the Leviathan. The Leviathan's claim to fame is that he's the biggest consumer in the world. That's the Leviathan's claim to fame. Maybe Africa is the Leviathan, who knows? The Leviathan's claim to fame is that he's the biggest consumer in the world. Avraham's claim to fame is that he's the biggest producer in the world. He's the producer of ideas that have changed the world. He's producers of energy, of an attitude to the world that has changed the world. Mm. That's what Avraham is. And there's no way you can deal with with consumption other than with production. You can't reason with it, you can't do anything. When the Leviathan sees the power of Avraham's productive ability, when the Leviathan sees what that is, that he can't tolerate, that he has to disappear entirely. And that's what we talked about, was the unique role that the Jew has to play. That there is nobody that has taught the world so much as the Jew has, through his understanding of the Torah, through his understanding of the Ribbono Shel Olam, through his being able to draw on the resources of the Torah. And we discussed over Sukkot also that all true innovation sources itself in the Torah, that all great ideas come from the Torah. The story my father always used to tell. I thought I might finish before you turn, but you were quick today. You're just a little quick for me. The story that my father used to tell concerning Remotel Pagamansky, who lived during the Second World War before and a little bit afterwards, and he was ill in a hospital in Vienna. And he was very frustrated. He was a big. He was an ilu. He was a tremendous genius and an enormous Talmud Chacham. And he had to lie in bed, and he was very impatient. So he decided to play a game with his doctor, who was an intellect. Vienna was the seat of Western intellectuals at that time. He said, "Tell me any new idea in Western civilization, and I'll tell you the same idea. I'll quote you a Chazal that will show you the same idea expressed more deeply and more succinctly than you can tell it to me." So the doctor started playing with him, and it worked. Whatever he gave, the bottle had an answer for. So the word went around Vienna, and all the philosophers came, and the scientists came, and the psychiatrists came, and then all the people who used to gather around there for their intellectual discussions used to gather around Remotel's bed, and they used to try it out, and they used to throw out ideas, new ideas that were being developed. And each one, he said, if it has any truth in it, if it doesn't have truth, I'll explain to you why it's wrong. And if it has truth, I'll show it to you in Chazal, expressed more deeply and more succinctly than any of you are able to express it. Which means there is no new idea that doesn't have its source, that doesn't have its origin in the Torah. That's the giving of the second Luchos. That gave man the capacity to be mechadish, to be able to think originally. And who is guardian of that capacity? That's the Jewish people. The Jew has that capacity. And that's why it's so troubling when you see Jewish people sitting back. That's why it's so troubling when you see Jewish people acting like consumers instead of like producers. We have such a koyach, we have such an ability and such a responsibility to be able to take that resource, to be able to take that amazing gift that the Ribbono Shel Olam has given us, that gift that Avraham discovered, that gift that the one true thing that a person can innovate with, can create with, that's true chesed. When a person works out how to serve the world, how to serve society, how to make a contribution to society, whether it's through his industry, whether it's through his profession, whether it's through his learning, whether it's through his social interrelationships, whether it's through his knowledge, whatever it is that he has, that he's able to form into a unique contribution so that wherever he goes and with whomever he interacts, there's something unique, something special, something contributive about the way he does it, that he leaves behind him more than he's consumed. That's something that the Jew has to be able to live by, that the Jew has to be able to teach, and that the Jew has to be able to develop.